the Truly Amazing Women Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. In each episode of the show, we shine a spotlight on the women who are making strides and changing lives.
Today's show is sure to inspire you, for we are here today with best-selling author Adriana Trigiani. Catherine Socret, author of The Help, says of Trigiani's work, "I don't know how Adriana Trigiani goes into her family's attic and emerges with these amazing stories. I'm just happy she does. If you're meeting her for the first time, get ready for a lifelong love affair." We couldn't agree more. Welcome to the show, Adriana.
I love being here, Hope. Thank you for having me.
First, let's talk about your current big hit, The Shoemaker's Wife. The story begins in the Italian Alps in 1905 and takes readers through New York City in the 1920s, the White Cape Lakes of northern Minnesota, and then both World Wars. For fans who have been following your award-winning work for years, this ambitious story is a departure from your first novel, the 2000 hit Big Stone Gap. So tell us about your path and especially about this new book.
Well, you know, you say something very interesting there in your question, Hope, that is it a departure? You know, to me a departure would mean that I tried something different. And really, to be honest, I'm just turning the same rock over and over again. The difference is I've had, you know, 15 novels or 15 books to just keep writing every year, and figuring out how to tell a story in the best possible way. And of course, in these years too, you know, I have the ability to read more and to really go back and think about storytelling. And I have to be honest, I thought The Shoemaker's Wife would be the first thing I ever wrote because it's such a compelling love story. But I didn't have really the experience to tell it, and I didn't have I couldn't figure out how to crack the story. It was such a big story. And it's my grandparents' love story, so I felt also a sense of obligation that I tell it in the best possible way. So, different from Big Stone Gap, where it was a what if, you know, I had a basic what if story, which is so interesting because as much as it's about growing up in Big Stone Gap and the world of the characters of Big Stone Gap, the impetus of the book started exactly where The Shoemaker's Wife started, in a small village in the Italian Alps. And I imagined if my mother's first cousin, who never married but was a real lover, had gotten a girl pregnant and she came to America and never told him. So that was that rock, really. So then when it came time not to do a memoir, but to really tell the story in novel form, I really tried to turn to the masters of storytelling like Edna Ferber. Stylistically, descriptively, writers that could really set the mood and the scene of landscapes that reflect the characters' journeys. You know, if I could aspire to Herman Woke, great writers that get in there and really dig in the earth of their characters. You know, my readers tell me a lot of names. They'll say Belva Plaine or Maeve Binchy or, you know, and then big landscapes, big writers, big themes. But Herber really had an effect on me with this, and it sort of accidental because I wanted to read autobiographies of writers born around the time of my grandparents. And of course, Edna was a bit older than my grandparents, but she was born in 1885, and she'd written two memoirs that didn't sell, her autobiographies, but I was captivated by them. And so after I read those, then I began to read her work in earnest. I'd read So Big before, the Pulitzer Prize winner from the 20s, but I hadn't read Giant, and I went back and I read all these books, and I just loved how she had scope, and I thought, well, this story has scope, and any part of this book could have been a novel, but I feel that the whole circle of it makes for a real juicy read, and that's really the path. If I'm going to describe the path is to really define the story and really define it in the terms of the way that you want to tell it. And I'm so lucky because I have an editor and publishers that have been very kind to me and let me find my path writing. So I try to get better with everything, so I don't really depart. I mean, the goal really is to make each book better than the last and always to be honing in and focusing on that single beam of light that's going to illuminate that one thing I'm trying to get across to my reader.
And is this, do you think, the biggest book you've written so far, and do you think it's your best?
Well, I can't really say that because they're like children. It was a very ambitious book to tackle, but perhaps one of the most succinct books I ever wrote was a memoir of my grandmother's called Don't Sing at the Table. And to be really honest, that was the hardest book I ever had to write because it was nonfiction. And I had to really honor who they were. And I had to really tell it like I saw it. And I couldn't paint it in any brush but my own. So I would say that was the hardest one.
Let's go back to Big Stone Gap. The main character is a sassy Italian-American with a big sense of humor. Is that a lot like you?
Well, I wouldn't call myself sassy. You know, sassy means, to me, sassy's kind of blousy, and sassy's kind of irreverent. I'm really not. I can be, but I'm really not. I would say that I'm more, I don't know what the opposite of sassy is, but it's like, I'm always trying to get to the pith of stuff. I'm not really interested in the flash. I'm interested in the depth of the point of something.
Well, and I think that's actually reflected in your life and your career path, which is our next question. We know that throughout the late 80s and 90s, you dreamt of becoming a playwright, and you eventually you ended up writing for The Cosby Show and A Different World, which is pretty impressive. But to get from that dream to the sitcoms was a bit of a leap. So tell us that story.
Well, I was getting plays produced in regional theaters, and I was working really hard. I was working year-round, but I was stretching grants of $2,500 over 9 months. You know, I was trying to be a working writer in a field where there wasn't any compensation. And I'm from a big family, and I have obligations to my family, and I had responsibilities, and I had to take care of myself, and I had to help my family. And so I was lucky to get into television.
And how did you do that? That's
plays.
A dream.
Well, they read my plays, these great producers, and I can give you a list of them. They read them and they hired me, and you can make a really wonderful living writing television, and I loved it. I loved the scope of writing television. But what happened is over the course of the time that I was doing it is that what the networks were buying was different from what I was selling. Now I think it's kind of coming around again to the way I did things, but again, I have responsibilities, and I had at that point a family, and I had to go to the place where I could make a living and also make art. You know, this is the conundrum of being creative, is that you have to figure out a way to be compensated for it so you can live the life.
Yeah.
And I've been very lucky again in that regard, but I've also insisted on it. And when something isn't working, I don't pretend it's not work, that it's working. I move. I do something different. Always creative, but that's where the surprises of my career have come. One of the things my dear agent Nancy Josephson told me when I was writing television, she said, you have to move to California. And I said, I can't really do that. You know, New York is what really charges me up. It's like, you know, I'm plugged in. I love this city. My people are here. People I understand and relate to. And I said, I really don't like driving around in a car, and I'm not a palm tree person. So it was a conundrum. I went out there and worked for a couple of years, but I never saw it as anything permanent. And if you wanted to make it permanent, you would have to stay there. And there was something else interesting that happened, Hope, when I was working in television, is you're very disconnected from the people who you are making the art for. So when you do a television show, it goes out to millions of people, and hopefully millions of people are watching it. Although now, compared to when I was doing The Cosby Show and the slice of the pie of the audience, now it's ridiculous. I mean, we wouldn't have even, 40 million people watched The Cosby Show, and now you're lucky if you get 800,000 people watching a show. There are the big hits where you get 12 million people watching, but you see what I'm saying here. A big hit now is 12 million people are watching your show. And it was far bigger numbers when I was doing it 20 years ago. Anyway, when you look at, the audience, if you're an artist, the most important thing to me is I'm really an Avon lady. I like to just knock on the door and connect to my reader or my viewer or the audience member. And in the theater, I had that close proximity because it's live. But in television, you would just see these bins of letters come from all over the country and around the world about your show, but you had no way to connect to those folks. And I subconsciously was trying to find that art form, and I didn't think it was going back to the theater. Because you have to understand with the theater, the resources are very limited. You have to become an academic now. I don't know how. I know very few people that make a living as a playwright or a lyricist or a composer or a librettist. Very few. They all teach. I didn't think I was qualified to teach, and it also wasn't the vision that I had for my artistic life. I wanted to be making art all the time. So books came into the horizon in a really natural way. I had won some prizes for this movie, Queens of the Big Time, a documentary that I made about my dad's hometown, Rosetta, Pennsylvania. And it won some prizes, and then it bought me some time. And I was asked by a producer to write what was my next movie, and I said, well, it's called Big Stone Gap. I just made it up off the top of my head. What is that? And I said, well, it's where I grew up. He said, what's the story? Well, I said, I've been fiddling with a story. Well, when I thought that I would get a movie made, I wrote the screenplay. And then, as we were developing the screenplay, I began to write the novel at the behest of my friend Suzanne Gluck, who's now my literary agent. When she read the screenplay, she said, I went to lunch with her and Ruth Pomerantz, who's now at Hyperion. She's an editor at Hyperion. And they said, this is a book, Adrian. You know, you want to have a child. I didn't have a baby then. They said, you got to get into books. And so I said, but I don't know how to write a novel. So I called Tom Dyja, a wonderful novelist. He has a book coming out soon called The Third Coast, about Chicago. And I said, Tom, how do you do this? And he said, just tell me the story. He said, what's your favorite novel? And I said, Jane Eyre. He said, tell me the story in first person. So I stood on the corner of Shawnee Avenue and Big Stone Gap in 1978, and I became, in my mind's eye, Ave Maria Mulligan, the town pharmacist whose mother's just died. And that's how it all started.
Oh, that gives me chills. How beautiful and dramatic and poetic at the same time. And you had already married, as you got into book writing, you had married Tim Stevenson, who's an Emmy-winning lighting designer at the David Letterman Show. Is that right?
He's at Late Show with David Letterman, and he's a brilliant lighting designer. I mean, my husband's really brilliant. And I admire him. And I'm still crazy about him. And
how long have you been married?
He's a good guy. December 1994.
Nice. And you have one daughter, Lucia, who's 10?
One 10-year-old daughter, Lucia Bonicelli is her name.
How beautiful. And there's a book that you wrote called Lucia. Which came first?
Well, the book came first and the baby came second.
What's that?
I knew I was going to name my daughter for my grandmother, Lucia Bonicelli. And if I had a boy, his name was going to be Francesco. Francesco Bonicelli Stevenson, and my friend, the great writer, director, producer, Michael Patrick King, said, why don't you just name your son, throw the ball at my head at recess? So that's how Lucia Lucia happened, because I couldn't remember anything when I was pregnant, and I had a business meeting, and I just said, well, here's the story, and I renamed the character. Her real name was Serafina, and I renamed her Lucia.
Because you could remember that one.
As I could remember in my pregnant state.
That's amazing. So you've written 15 books. That's quite prolific. Did you set out to write so many?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I only get better with practice. I'm not, look, had I been born in a different family, or had, you know, I had a pope and he, you know, floated me some dough to sculpt something, we'd be having a different conversation. But I am completely driven by survival and fear. And the getting better part is more important than all the rest of it. But I find that, you know, every artist needs a deadline. You just need a deadline to make yourself get to that place. So that's, those are my kind of driving, and they're not real always. Fear isn't always real. It's imagined, but it works for me.
What are you working on right now?
Well, I have two more books coming in, so they'll be my 16th and 17th books. The third in the Viola series and the third in the Valentine series.
And you
and
feel
one
like
is
you're
written and it's at the editor, and the other one's going into the editor this week.
And you feel like you're connected to your audience writing as an author? You get out and you meet your readers?
Well, see, sometimes you get lucky in your life. I really love the close connection that I have to my readers. And I answer everything on Facebook, and I answer all the emails, and I really tour extensively. So my readers have access to me all the time, which is pretty great.
Yeah, that is. That's great for them and good for you, I'm sure.
Yeah, I learn a lot from them.
Yeah, what they want, and have they changed a story?
I took it to such a degree that when I went to Italy to learn how to make shoes, an old friend, Gina Casella from Philadelphia, that I met in Italy, she's an importer and from Italy, and I called her up and, you know, this is like 8 years ago, I said, I've got to learn how to make shoes. She says, well, we'll put the trip together. Maybe it wasn't eight, it was 5 years ago. And we went over, and on the plane ride home, I said, could you do this for my readers? And she said, well, let me study the market and see what I'll get back to you. She came back to me and she said, we could do this. So ever since, we've had Adriana Trigiani tours where you go to Italy and walk in the steps of the characters.
Oh,
we have walking tours, we have fabulous walking tours in Greenwich Village. You know, we keep them very economical, but they have to be first class because I'm a diva.
And how do people learn about doing that?
Oh, just go to my website, adrianatrigiani.com or Adriana Trigiani Tours, and it comes right up. And Gina runs her tour business, the tour company, like I run my book life. She's completely accessible and answers all questions, and she keeps the groups small so that you have an enchanted experience in Italy.
That's beautiful. Well, we'll definitely have to check that out. You also have a wonderful relationship with your brother. I had asked you
to... My honorary brother.
Your honorary brother.
I have two real brothers.
And this is your honorary brother that you talked about in the...
Mario Cantone. Mario Cantone is my honorary brother. But my real-life brothers are Michael in Nashville and Carlo in Brooklyn.
So how did he get to be your honorary brother?
Well, Mario Cantone is a brilliant comedian, brilliant actor. He can sing. He's really, really funny. And he has a big extended family like I do. So we sort of merged. He's married to Jerry. They have a wonderful, and then they've been together as long as Tim and I have been together. And we're four foodies. We love to go out when I do go out. And he's just, we share a sensibility. He would say that I'm prudish, and I would say he's too bold, but it's all, who can be too bold? But he's fabulous, and we have a great relationship.
And does he work with you, or you just hang together, you're just best buds?
Well, we're going to be cooking up a couple things coming up here, but he did the audiobook version of Rococo, my novel about my homage to the Jersey Shore, and he was brilliant at it. So that hatched some ideas for us to work together.
Excellent. So this is our last question. For those who aspire to be a best-selling novelist, what's the one piece of advice that you would give them?
Oh, one piece of advice. Write your book. Finish
it.
Finish the book, and then get it into the hands of people who know what they're doing.
Excellent.
That's what I would say. Finish it.
Excellent. Well, we can't wait to see what else you cook up, and so we can have you back on to talk about your newest book. So we'll keep in touch with you.
Please do, Hope. It's always a thrill.
That's it for today's episode of the Truly Amazing Women Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. If you're a truly amazing woman or know someone who is, don't hesitate to contact us. Simply log on to www.trulyamazingwomen.com and fill out the proposal form. We've profiled more than 250 women on the site who fit the bill of being truly amazing, and we look forward to honoring more. Who will be our next truly amazing woman? Tune in next week for a new episode on www.incandescentradio.com. Here's to your incredible, indelible success.